The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents. Consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Friday morning California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you for tuning in. We appreciate your being here. Also, let me take this opportunity to wish everybody a really great, happy, and enjoyable, wonderful July 4th holiday weekend, which is coming up for those of us in the States and those of us living or traveling overseas. Have a great holiday and keep it safe. And if you're driving, pay attention because the other guy is probably not paying attention. And we want all of you back Tuesday evening for our next Space Show program, as there won't be a program on Sunday or Monday due to the holiday. But we're here today. We have a great show planned for you. We have a guest on who I've wanted to have on the program for several years, and I'm really happy that that is about to happen, and I will introduce him in just a minute. But first, our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to call in and have access to the phone, even if you happen to be listening at work, and the number is 1-866-687-7223. For those of you that are phone shy or listening at work and you cannot call for some reason or another, the email address for today is drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So be sure to notice the comprehensive website newsletter that's on the homepage. And then if you scroll over to the far right, and then go down a little bit, you'll see upcoming shows. Remember, that is also our blog. So when a show is listed in upcoming shows, you can start posting comments on it even before the show goes live. And many people do that. And many of the guests will sometimes put links to data up there that they want to draw your attention to for their upcoming interview. So do check that out. That's a great feature. And if you're on the website newsletter, scroll down toward the bottom of it, and you will see our schedule for planned upcoming shows. And we're booking guests into July and August, and actually a little bit into September already. And all of that information is there for you to see. There are also other menus up in the upper left, so check them out. There are links to other websites, to our logoware store at Cafe Press under the support menu. And I think you'll find a lot of things that are interesting. So if you have any questions about any of this, please don't hesitate to give me a call. We also have a database search engine. If you're searching for a guest, it goes by last name. So just put in the last name, and you should find all of the programs where that person was either mentioned or was the actual guest. Also remember that we do have the website newsletter and the short email newsletter, which I send out early Monday morning, 6 a.m. California time. If you want to be on that email newsletter distribution list, please send me your email address. Everything we do is archived, and you can either listen right off of our website or very rapidly download the programs. Also, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org, and your support keeps us on the air. That's about as bottom line as I can get. For those of you that pay U.S. federal taxes, your gift to the Space Show, One Giant Leap, is tax deductible, and the same is true for those of you who pay California taxes. We are a California public benefit corporation. check us out at onegiantleapfoundation.org or thespaceshow.com. I'm happy to respond to any email questions that you may have. drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked. All of you have permission to download our programs, share them with people, pass them around, although it's easier to send people the URLs because our shows run about 25 megabytes. There's a couple of rules with that. As I say each week, don't do anything commercial with our programs. Don't edit any of the programs. Don't put clips up on YouTube or any other website, and then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. Please read our full copyright statement. It is at the bottom of every one of our website pages at thespaceshow.com, as well as onegiantleapfoundation.org. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me about that. Podcasting is through gigadial.net, and we thank Andrew for that service. We're in iTunes and a host of other places on the net. If you have any questions or problems with podcasting, let me know. It seems that most of the problems are always around smartphones. Always. So if you do have any questions, we'll do our best to troubleshoot with you and help you resolve the problems. And then we do have sponsors on our website. You'll see the banner ads going across. So please check them out from time to time and click on them, and you know, you'll get more of a sponsor message. Without the sponsors, we wouldn't be doing these shows, so they are important to us, and many of them have services and products that are important for you. So the first half of today's program is brought to you by Orbital ATK. They are a global leader in aerospace and defense technology and known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And congratulations, guys, on your very successful five-segment rocket booster test the other day. Also for the first segment, Integrated Space Analytics has the Integrated Space Plan, which is a highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a space-faring race. See how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. Join their discussions, see their updates, participate in exclusive interactive features, and you can even buy your own full-color poster of their plan. It's in two different sizes. It's a useful and inspiring tool, and they think it should be on the wall of everyone who is serious about space development. So again, check them out, thespaceplan, all one word, .com. And that brings me to our guest today, and as I said, I've wanted to have Courtney Stad on the show since about 2010, when I was introduced to him by Dr. David Whalen, who was then the department head of University of North Dakota. He's since has retired and is over in Bakersfield, although I'm still in touch with David. And Courtney had written some articles, and he had a pretty cool PowerPoint at the time that I had gotten ahead of or gotten a hold of, and that PowerPoint was the bureaucratic Hydra versus the final frontier, actors and processes that shape and drive U.S. space policy. And he's very well known and very well respected in the space field. He manages Washington operations and business development for a 26-year-old leading-edge quality control chain, supply chain software company, the Milwaukee-based TIP Technology, which supports many of the leading defense and aerospace firms, including New Space Ventures. Their website is TIPTech.com. And for the past 38 years, his career path has been a mix of senior government leadership and corporate executive jobs, primarily focused on encouraging the emergence of competitive commercial space marketplace, which I think we're starting to see at this point. You can read his full bio. It is up on the Space Show website for this program. I urge you to read it. It's more important that we spend our time talking with Courtney. And, Courtney, a great welcome to you. It's been a long time coming, hasn't it?
Yes, it has, David. And it's a real pleasure, real honor to be on this show.
So you've been a little bit on vacation for a couple of years, right?
Yes. Well, indeed. Just let me address that for a minute. I got caught up in what can only be described as an absolute legal nightmare a few years ago. So with your audience's forbearance, just a minute on it, and then we can get back to what you and I both care about in your audience, which is the world of space. For about 5-6 years, I was pursued by a former NASA inspector general who himself was actually forced from office due to abusive power allegations, but not before he spent years going after me. He became my equivalent of the inspector in Les Miserables, Inspector Javert, and just wore me down, body, soul, financially, myself and my family. Ultimately, I pled to a count of fraud, anyone ever interested in why people plead, Judge Rakoff, a prominent judge in Manhattan, wrote a wonderful piece that's easily available on the web called Why Innocent People Plead Guilty. But the whole horror was made worse by my attorney, who, and I know this sounds like a movie, but who's now a fugitive from the FBI. He ended up stealing for both me, other clients. I've discovered in recent months, David, that he didn't do half of what he claimed that he was doing on my behalf in representing me. And in fact, in many ways, he's sort of a modern-day con artist like the Ferdinand Waldo Demera, who was the figure upon which the 61 Great Imposter movie was based. A number of people have asked that I relitigate all this, but I got to tell you, I have neither the resources and I don't have the emotional fortitude to subject my family and myself back to the meat grinder. But the good news is that the community, the space community, has been really very welcoming and very supportive. And I even had a senior government official come to me and say, look, we realize you've railroaded, and it was like watching a slow-motion wreck. But we're happy that you're back and getting your traction, and that's where I am. So, and by the way, one other item, I have discovered yet again that much of what, or at least a few items that are about the case on the web, much of it is inaccurate. So, if, I know at least a couple of people are interested in, you know, a book or whatever to try to put the case in greater context and elaborate more on the political motivations sort of pushed this IG to do what he did. But
well, I remember Courtney that we were absolutely expecting the judge ruling to either dismiss or to find you not guilty. I mean, we were stunned.
You and me.
well, but I don't mean just me. I mean the space community was really. Yeah. Stunned by all this, but while you were away on vacation, you taught space classes to your
I was at a federal camp, a facility that did not have a fence, and it was all nonviolent folks. And by the way, what a microcosm of people. I there were judges there were ex-prosecutors among the population, as well as nonviolent drug dealers and so forth, quite a range. The staff were mystified, frankly, that I was there. But when they found out about my background, they asked me to teach a course. So that really was my salvation. I came up with a course on space travel, and I'm proud to tell you that over 200 of the gentlemen at that facility went through my program. And we talked about the history of space travel. I threw in some cosmology. Bit of a challenge because I had occasionally people who had a PhD in chemical engineering. I had a number of medical doctors, a host of lawyers, and occasionally people who had a first-grade education. So being able to sort of thread that needle was a bit of a challenge, but
did they seem interested in space, or were they
fascinated
just
by it?
So they weren't just there because they didn't have anything else to do.
Fascinated by it. In fact, what I said to the gentleman, I said, "Look, you know, I'm not certifying you in some vocation for those of you who are looking to be trained in something that would give you an honest living after this experience. But what I can give you is about an hour and a half of liberation from this place and to give you a sense of the beauty and the vastness of the cosmos. And to a person, they were fascinated, and I had a sense of that when I would overhear them on the phone with family, and nothing gave me greater satisfaction than hearing some of these guys who had had no exposure to space in any shape or form, testing their own children using material that I had provided them, and making up their own questions. And by the way, very, very quickly on this topic, the Bureau of Prisons is quite antiquated, and I had colleagues at different federal agencies, including NASA, of course, when they heard that I was teaching the course, wanted to send me materials. And the prison bureaucracy would not allow it. Instead, people would send me, through the person private mail, they would send me books and articles and so forth. And that became my material, my teaching material. Also, there were no overhead projectors and things of that sort. So I found a young man that was in a little arts and crafts. There weren't too many extracurricular activities or classes. I don't want to mislead here, but there was one arts and crafts program, and there was a young man making little cars out of Coca-Cola cans and so forth. So I brought him a picture of a satellite and a space shuttle and so forth, and he made models for me, and that's what I used in class. And then I found an artist who about a half an hour before each class would draw the pictures on the class, you know, the solar system and so forth, and that's what I would teach to. So it was, you know, I wouldn't subject anybody to that experience, but it was yet another case where space, certainly for me, was my salvation.
Now, since then, was this after your release or before? When did you take a ride on the centrifuge?
That was recent. couple of years, I've been getting traction back into the space community at large. You referred to TIP Technologies. I've been helping them in the business development part of their business, particularly in the new space world. But I have also been attending some conferences, and actually on behalf of TIP Tech, I went to the annual FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation, which I used to head back in the 80s, and they hold this annual conference in Washington, D.C., it's a two-day conference. This one was held back early February, and I was sitting in the audience listening to the speakers. There were a couple hundred people. And one of the researchers was from the University of Texas Medical Branch, and they were doing FAA-sponsored research involving average people, quote-unquote, who might be interested in being a space traveler aboard a Virgin Galactic or Dream Chaser or Blue Origin, whatever. And they were doing research to see how average people would react to the stresses of space travel, to provide data to the FAA so the FAA could shape their rulemaking that would govern over time the protocols and the guidance for allowing people to participate as space travelers. So the researcher asked for volunteers, for people who might be interested in participating in their human centrifuge. And I think it was the only one who put his hand up. And so I went up to the lady during a break, and I said, "Look, I'm in my early 60s. I'm overweight." She said, "You're perfect." So she said that they would be back in touch. I went through a medical exam and signed a couple of different waivers and so forth. And then several weeks ago, traveled to Southampton, Pennsylvania, to a facility called NASSTAR, where they have a centrifuge, a human centrifuge with a gondola. And I showed up there in the morning of June 1st, and there were two other gentlemen who had flown, one case from Texas, the other from Tennessee. and we were giving morning classroom instruction about what the experience would be like and the type of techniques to deal with the G-forces that we would be subjected to. And then they put a bunch of electrodes on me, and then I ended up being the first one out, so they took me into the gondola and strapped me in. And I must tell you that the graphics were fantastic. So the centrifuge itself is spun at about 90 some odd miles an hour, and you're subjected to about 4 to 6 G's, so enough to push you back in the seat and stretch your face a bit. It's not the type of G-forces that combat pilots are subjected to, of course, but enough to get your attention. And in the first time I went around, it replicated a Virgin Galactic flight. So I could feel being dropped from the mothership and then being rocketed off to the edge of space, and the graphics were spectacular in terms of viewing the beauty of the Earth and the blackness of space, and then felt the forces associated with descent. They subjected me to an emergency scenario, an unexpected one, and I have to tell you and your listeners, I failed it dismally.
How can you fail it?
There were about 9 instructions you're given while lights are flashing and all sorts of different noises are going off. And you're supposed to follow those instructions sequentially. And, you know, I maybe remembered 3 or 4 of them. I was told afterwards that was not unusual, that most people, tended to not retain all the various and sundry guidances that you're given. Again, it's part of the research. I liked it so much that I did it again. They allowed me to go back, in this instance, replicated essentially a dream chaser scenario. And for those among your audience, that's the one that takes off from an airfield and goes again to the edge of space for a suborbital experience. Somewhat different G-force experience, but it was tremendous.
Did you have any, on reentry, did you have any back pain or back issues?
Here's the funny thing. I have had some pinched nerve issues. So I actually, when I drove out there, I'd had some pain issues in both legs. And when I was came back that night, I realized that I had no pain. All the pain had vanished. And I'm speculating that maybe the breathing exercises and just the intensity of the experience for some reason did some realignment issue that caused the pain to go away. It came back a couple of days later, but it was great. Interesting observation, David. The researchers asked the two gentlemen and myself afterwards some questions about what we would recommend if we were in a position to recommend directly to the FAA the types of rules that should govern space travel, up to and including whether a centrifuge experience like this should be a requirement. Now, I should add that I was one of the people back in the early 80s involved in the original drafting of the Commercial Space Launch Act of 84, and when I went on to become the director of the licensing office at what is now the FAA, I actually oversaw the first implementing regulations. When we drafted both the statute and then the regulations, we emphasized performance-based. We were all, you know, free market orientation, wanted to ensure that we weren't doing anything to smother this fledgling industry. And so my inclination is to oppose any specific prescriptions, detailed prescriptions by the federal government. With that said, this experience indicates to me that I would certainly require some minimal level of classroom instruction. I think people need to have some understanding of the challenges associated with flying in these craft, certainly familiarity with any emergency procedures and so forth. As to the centrifuge experience itself, my personal opinion is that I think the companies like Virgin Galactic ought to be encouraged to have their prospective passengers experience it, but I think it ought to be up to the, frankly, to the individual company, and not have it mandated. But that's my two cents. One of the researchers indicated to me that, and I found this fascinating, that and they terminated this particular research actually the day after I left. I think I was there on the penultimate day. So about 160 volunteers have participated of all ages. And they indicated that they've had a few cases where volunteers, after having gone through the medical exam, signed the release, fill out a bunch of surveys that are provided by the researchers, some cases flying across the country to participate at NASTAR. The electrodes will be put on them. They'll be let out to the gondola. The door will be opened up. And at that point, they say, "I can't do this," and they'll walk away from it.
Why?
Well, I guess you have to ask each person, but they would just decided that they just couldn't handle it, couldn't handle the stress, couldn't handle, presumably, the you know, it's a fairly small area, so if you do have claustrophobia, it's going to be an issue. If you have concerns about motion sickness, it's a problem. But that's an interesting insight, isn't it? Because think about people who are enthused about about space travel, or boasting to friends and peers about going on to Virgin Galactic or whatever craft it may be. And then the day arrives, right, and they're being led out to this live breathing machine. Who knows how people might react. So in light of that, I think the more you can educate and inform, and certainly the centrifuge gives you, short of microgravity, gives you a pretty good sense of what the experience is all about.
So is
certainly worth considering.
When you're in the gondola, is it completely closed off to the outside world? You can't see outside?
You cannot. Your connection to the world is through audio. So you're hearing their mission control, and they're giving you instructions and narrating the experience to you.
But you see the profile on the window, on the screens, right?
That is correct.
So you're not like you're in an MRI machine.
That is correct.
But I'll tell you, I'm claustrophobic, and yeah. I have, when I injured my back, I had to do a whole series of these stupid MRIs. I would go up to the damn machine. I would, get on the table. They would be all set, and they'd go to, turn on the thing and roll me into the machine, and I would absolutely freak out and abort the MRI at that instant after I had a friend take me that took off from work, all of this crap.
I can appreciate that,
And the only way I got through it was they dosed me, started dosing me with Valium an hour before the MRI. To calm me down. Plus, they played music they had a whole array of music. So that, and the technicians were really skilled working with claustrophobic people. So they knew exactly what to say and tell you about the process, but they didn't say anything that would, inadvertently, trigger any kind of claustrophobic response. They were really trained in it. I have to tell you, they were outstanding. So I can really get it. You walk up, you've done all of this prep work, you're ready to go, you're claustrophobic, and you're going to get into this tight little damn thing. And if you're a big guy, it can be really tight, like the MRI machine. And the next thing you know is you can't mentally handle it because you can't be enclosed.
Right. And hopefully, as will come clear during our conversation, there's no bigger fan, no bigger booster of commercial space than your guest. But I think we have to be realistic about introducing individuals into a brand new experience, and it's going to require people and the companies involved to be very thoughtful about how to educate people, prepare people for these experiences.
You know, I also, at the spacesuit lab at UND with Pablo de Leon, I've put on the spacesuits, and everything's cool until you put the visor down on the helmet.
Yes.
And you put the visor down on the helmet, and it is freak out city. And then I've been to some personal development seminars years and years ago, and one of them had us get inside a coffin. I don't know if you've ever had this experience.
No.
And they would shut the lid on the coffin, and it is really airtight and light tight. I mean, you know, no light or anything gets in. And if you are claustrophobic, as soon as that head panel comes down on top of you, that is also really freaky city.
Amazing. I remember about 20-some-odd years ago, I was over in Russia with a colleague, and we were allowed to climb into a Soyuz, this without spacesuits. My admiration for our astronauts and cosmonauts went up an order of magnitude, because if you have any hint of claustrophobia, I can't imagine what it must be like.
Well, yeah, I've been in the shuttle, and it's the same way. I don't know how they can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, but it would seem to me that if you're going to spend all this money to do a suborbital flight on one of these companies,
yes,
you damn well ought to, before you fork over the money, find out if you can handle it.
Agreed. And Virgin Galactic, as your listeners know, is charging about $250,000. A number of people have put their houses up as
security
for the
security.
Earnest money and so forth. So it's a big deal. I don't believe that any of this represents insurmountable barriers. I think there are ways to deal with each and every one of them, but it gets down to being realistic about the expectations, the challenges. And again, if I had not gone through this centrifuge experience, I wouldn't have been as sensitized to it as I am. And kudos to the FAA, frankly, to encourage the research so that they can thread that needle, which personally I think they've done a pretty good job over the years of focusing on public safety, but doing it in a way that doesn't discourage the still very fragile and fledgling industry. And while I'm at it, I do want to have a call out to Patty Gray Smith, who passed away recently. She was the director, associate administrator of the office in the 90s, and really set the tone,
very good,
I think,
lady.
A very positive tone for that office. And tragically, she passed away recently, and I just want to say I think she made quite a contribution to creating that culture, which I think we all have a vested interest in helping to preserve.
You have an email question from Bob in Louisville, Kentucky, and he says, Courtney, which flight profile did you prefer, Dream Chaser or Virgin Galactic?
Well, Bob, I'm so passionate about spaceflight that I actually savored both. I did find in that particular scenario the Virgin Galactic was a little bit more congenial, a little less G-force, if you will, than what I experienced with Dream Chaser, but that was really on the margins, and I would say that both were really terrific experiences. And if I was forced to make a choice, I'd probably go Virgin Galactic, but I would be delighted to experience either one.
So do you have any indication of what the rules will be on spaceflight participants?
I don't. The researchers indicated that they hope to have their research sliced and diced and written up by the end of the year, this fall. And then it's up to the regulators, of course, of the FAA in terms of next steps. So I really don't have a clue. Although fingers crossed, we'll see some commercial tourism starting to deploy in relatively near future, and you know, it'll be incumbent on the FAA sooner than later to start to generate you know, the regulatory framework for all this.
I know you did a new space industry study fairly recently for a commercial paying partner, or I should say customer. What can you tell us about that study that's not proprietary that you can share with us?
Yeah, let me stay at about 50,000 feet, but I came out of the study cautiously optimistic. You know, I've been involved in commercial space, as you indicated in my introduction, for about well over 37, 38 years now. So I've been through a number of waves, starting back in 1980 with a company that some of your listeners may recall was called ARC Technologies. We renamed it Starstruck. Ultimately, it evolved into American Rocket Company. And so I've seen these waves come and go. I will tell you that I came away assessing the industry impressed with the sophistication, by and large, with today's business leaders. I came away pretty impressed with the sophistication of the venture capital firms that are backing a number of these companies. And for those of us who had been hoping way back when, again, in my case, back in late 70s, early 80s, when I got into this area, that there would be a proliferation of entrepreneurial interest across the board in commercial space, this is shaping up to be a wonderful time. And I just wish, instead of being my early 60s, I could join the entrepreneurial generation in their 20s and 30s, because it's just a very exciting time. So cautiously optimistic. What I certainly am finding is, and you've addressed this in some of your own programs in recent months, I think we are slowly, and for some of us agonizingly slowly, but beginning to address the access to the cost of access to space challenge, which has been such a damper for decades. Kudos, of course, to SpaceX and other companies like Blue Origins that seem to be making progress. The fact that there are more and more ways to get to space, the fact that hardware, software are becoming more of a commodity and driving costs down, computing, solar cells, battery technology, software-designed radios, sensors, the costs and availability of those are such that it gives me great hope for the future commercial space, the standardization of satellite buses, for example, more and more agile manufacturing methods. So all that is to the good. You know, and I, at the risk of leaving some of the more exciting, some of the other exciting companies out, I've been impressed with several named companies out there. You know, Planetary Resources is an example. Skybox, Spire, in the digital globe, all that in the sensor world, and the use of nanoracks, Jeff Mambers' company, in terms of use for small satellites, nano CubeSat types off the ISS. There's quite a mix of players that give me hope, you know, long term. With that said, you know, we have, oh, and the other is the amount of venture capital going into this. It's quite interesting to look at the startup report that Christensen of the Tory Group put out. It's very exciting to see how much money is going into the commercial space, about $1.8 billion, if memory serves, in 2015 alone, tripling, or doubling, I should say, the total of the total previous 15 years combined. So that's exciting on the surface, but when you pick up the hood and dive into it a bit more, you find that a good percentage of that money is represented by Google's investment in SpaceX, roughly about $1 billion. You've got the OneWeb satellite company that represents about $500 million. So you see where a couple of large investments really eat up a huge percentage of that money. But again, the fact that that those investments are being made, I think, speaks well. Overall, I'm optimistic, but it still remains a highly speculative arena. The big issue with all these companies in the launch services, in the data sensor world, is can they build a customer base willing to pay for the services? You know, I'm old enough to have gone back to the early days of GPS, Global Positioning System, and I had the pleasure of working with the pioneer in the commercialization of that, Charlie Trimble, back in the early 90s. And there was a huge proliferation of GPS companies trying to make a living from that service. And many of them went out of business because it was very difficult to figure out a way to make money in what quickly became a commodity and an embedded technology. So I think that challenge is facing a lot of these companies today.
Do you have any favorite sectors of new space that you like? I mean, do you think the launch industry, I mean, you know, SpaceX is clearly such a great leader, as is Orbital ATK, but is there any new space type of industry other than that you see emerging that can survive it?
Well, I think the Sierra Nevada company is very impressive with their launch vehicle. They have a very savvy, very experienced management team. They have a pretty deep bench. They really have gone to school on their launch, their spacecraft. So I am pretty sanguine that I think they can get some traction. Jeff Bezos, we've long learned never, ever, ever to discount anything that Jeff Bezos decides is worth putting his money in. And I had the pleasure of listening to him give a talk at the annual Space Symposium conference last April in Colorado Springs. And it was, it really gave me a lift. He indicated that he's been passionate about space since the age of 8, that essentially he views Amazon as having hit the lottery. It now basically helps him fund his true passion. And it's very clear that he has the resources to play the long game in terms of building a low-cost system. He said that it's very clear that without a sufficiently very low-cost access to space, that many of these other applications are going nowhere. So I'm pretty confident that if anyone can do it, Mr. Bezos and his team can. So I'm optimistic on that front. Planetary Resources, for those of your listeners who follow that part, they're the ones who are focusing on asteroid mining. And frankly, I was a bit skeptical as to how they could achieve return in a reasonable time frame for their investors, but I've been very pleased to see that they've done well in their recent capital raises and that they see market opportunity by taking some of the sensors that they've been developing for asteroids and focusing on the Earth, on some Earth resource exploitation. That shows me that it's an agile company and one that is keeping their eye on the ball in terms of showing how they can get some near-term return on investment while they keep their eye on their long-term vision. OneWeb is a company I certainly would keep an eye on. They've got some very talented people running it. Of course, Airbus is a key partner. So that's sort of a quick sampling of who I think is possible, and apologies to a number of the ones that I'm sure I'm leaving out.
Do you think that all the startups that are coming in, you'd be surprised how many requests I get from new space companies starting up that are using Kickstarter or Indiegogo for fun. I probably get 3 or 4 requests a week for for new space operations wanting to start up using Kickstarter.
Wow.
It's just, you know, I didn't know there were so many different opportunities for, you know, coming across on a Kickstarter plan. And they're all have an idea of how they're going to make it in space. And I just can't help but be skeptical, but I don't know.
What's wonderful is the proliferation, is the fact that the genius of the entrepreneur is being allowed to try to see if they can convert what I call technical possibility into market opportunity. And the emergence of these crowd financing mechanisms is yet more fodder for these companies to see if they can do it or not. The straitjacket that has been around our industry for so long in terms of government monopoly, when I first got into this business, it was basically NASA and the Defense Department, was really a stranglehold. And you had this iron triad, you know, the large major aerospace companies that were the contractors to captive contractors to the government, and of course had their supporters on Capitol Hill. Your one of your previous guests, Bob Zimmerman, has talked very eloquently about the pork politics that has shaped and civil space for so long, and the wonderful news is that stranglehold, although still exists in some form, has greatly loosened, so that we're seeing these entrepreneurs finding opportunities, and let's see how many of them do get traction. In the entrepreneurial world in general, terrestrial firms, the vast majority go out of business. But the genius of the American marketplace, and there's really no place like it in the world, is that you can convert a notion, a concept, into a business plan, and you'll find, you know, if you persevere and work hard enough, you'll get the resources and the team to try to execute, and then it's the marketplace will make or break that dream. And I have been involved in several over my trajectory where I have lost my shirt. I've gone belly up in one commercial company or another. But I will tell you that there's no opiate like it in the world in a startup. When you have a concept that you find compelling, exciting, and you find some like-minded colleagues join you in that adventure, there is nothing like it.
I have a couple of emails for you, but we're a little past the halfway point, so I'm going to take our pause right here.
Okay.
And when we come back, listeners, I will ask more of your questions. And for those of you that can give Courtney a call, the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. And email remains drspace, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Back in three, everyone.
Advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody, and we are in part two of the Space Show program for Friday, July 1st. Boy, is time going fast in this year. Again, this is the July 4th weekend. Everybody do keep it safe and pay attention if you're out driving around. And remember, there is no show on Sunday and there is no program on Monday. We are back live on Tuesday evening. We have two sponsors for the second segment. AIAA is one of our sponsors, and they have five annual forums. They're really conferences, but they now call them forums. SciTech, Defense, Aviation, Propulsion and Energy, and Space. And I will be at Space 2016 in Long Beach. If you're going to be there in September, find me or email me. I'll give you my cell phone so that you can text me. And I'd love to meet up with you while we're at the conference. Also, remember, I'm looking for someone who has a physics background who might want to go down to Long Beach State and at Cal Fullerton and see Woodward's lab and get a tour on the Woodward effect and Mach thruster and help me understand if there's anything to that or not. But somebody needs a physics background to go down there with me and understand it, because when I did it last year, it was way over my head. Anyway, AIAA is a great aerospace professional industry organization, and they have more than 30,000 individuals that are members. They represent 88 countries. They have about 100 corporate members. They are unbelievable with their programs and their papers. You can get close to 200,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers, out of AIAA files. Their members make the world safer, more connected, more accessible. Check them out, AIAA.org. And then one of my favorite ever companies, Celestis, which is the premier space burial company, sponsors us. And they have really cool historical messages. This one is about Kraft Ericke. And among 24 people on board the first Celestis Memorial spaceflight back in 97 was Dr. Kraft Ericke, who was known in the space community for his contributions to technology and the philosophical meaning of space development. He was a graduate of the Berlin Technical University, where he studied celestial mechanics and nuclear physics. And he came to the U.S. after World War II, and he then helped develop the Atlas and the Centaur launch vehicles, back then with General Dynamics. In the 70s, Dr. Ericke led the advanced studies at Rockwell while working independently to produce the first comprehensive concept and rationale for space industrialization and commercialization. You can Google Kraft Ericke, E-H-R-I-C-K-E, imperative, and you'll read an incredible document that is as much vibrant and alive today as it was when he wrote it. Like Dr. Ericke, there have been over 1,000 people who have been flown on Celestis' Memorial space flights. They shared a passion for space, and their families and friends helped them fulfill their dreams. And my mom went up on a couple of their flights, as she was very supportive when I was writing my doctoral dissertation, as were my two dogs, and they also went up on a couple of the flights. So that's Celestis.com or Celestis.org, a great way to honor people that were in the space world. Did you ever meet Kraft Ericke?
I did. In fact, I was thinking, as you were speaking about the great doctor back in the 70s, I remember going to a couple of lectures of his, and he had a very, very compelling vision that was backed up by a very deep technical background as well. And, I would say that he was one of those that had a big influence on me and other members of my generation that had the honor of listening to him.
I was going to go to emails with listeners, but you have a caller on hold, so let's go to your caller.
Okay.
Good morning, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Happy July 4th weekend, and who are you and where are you?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show. Do you celebrate July 4th down there?
There are a fair number of Americans here in town because it's kind of an expat community. So there are a few parties.
Mm-hmm. Just curious. You're on the line with Courtney, so go ahead.
I wanted to ask, I don't know how much you know about the international scene for this, but commercial space is so dominated by the United States right now.
Yes.
And that sort of concerns me in the long view. Do you see hope for that spreading out, or is that going to tend to continue?
I do see hope. I don't think it's a coincidence that you see so much entrepreneurial space activity here, just given our pro-entrepreneurial culture. But having said that, there are signs of some new space in other countries. Random examples: in Australia, you have the Sabre Astronautics, which is working on a spacecraft system that can automatically repair itself if damaged. LaunchBox is another foreign one. Astroscale, a Singapore-based company that's focusing on space debris removal technology, and I'm sure there are others that I'm...
Well, New Zealand has them too.
Rocket Labs as well, and I know that Israel has a number of companies that are eagerly getting into the space as well. So I see signs. I'm sanguine that we'll see more and more companies abroad, and probably see more alliances and more partnerships. We certainly have no monopoly here in the U.S. on ingenuity and innovation abroad. And so I'm hopeful that from Mexico to, fill in the blanks, you'll see more and more companies over time. What we need are successes. We need some near-term successes that will help continue to fuel and motivate interest.
Is there access to the American market and American firms in any way degraded by being an international company?
Well, it certainly complicates matters, but there are certainly examples of cross-border partnerships. I think that, I'm trying to think. Airbus, I mentioned earlier, and OneWeb is an example. I know that, Digital Globe has entered into some partnerships abroad. I used to work with Bigelow Aerospace, which you may be aware has their beam demonstration module on the space station. Mm-hmm. And Bigelow has entered into a number of foreign agreements overseas with potential customers abroad. So I'm optimistic that that's possible. Now, we still have export control problems, challenges. There have been efforts in this administration to try to streamline some of that, but there's still a lot more work to be done in terms of lowering some of these challenges to working with our overseas partners. But I think it's necessary. Space, by definition, is global. And I emphasize we do not have a monopoly on ingenuity and innovation.
Kim?
Yep. I'm Canadian, and Canadians have some advantage of this because of the proximity of the United States. And,
yes.
We have a few companies coming together, but, Europe and a lot of the other, I guess you have to call them first world or developed nations, they have a bit of a disadvantage simply because they're not so close to the equator. America has Florida. That in itself, do things like that play in much, or is it really mostly the market that you have developed there?
Well, I think a number of factors. Certainly geography is critical, but You know, we built up our infrastructure, basically forced through military preparedness and the Cold War rivalry with the Soviets certainly forced an emergence of an infrastructure that made us first and foremost. But I think that just the vastness and the diversity of our marketplace and the funding sources and just the talent base overall has allowed us to leverage and build this diverse marketplace. So I think that certainly has heavily contributed to making the U.S. as preeminent as it is. But with that said, Canada has a number of very interesting companies, of course, in the earth imaging field. There are others that are looking at the space access and spaceport. Occasionally, one reads about interest in trying to resurrect a spaceport over there. So I'm optimistic that you'll see Canada and others begin to really make their presence felt even more than they have to date.
Well, I'll wish you both a happy Canada Day.
Thank you.
That's today, and it's a nice NAFTA weekend because Canada Day is today, and the other side of the long weekend is July the 4th. So,
Kim,
a good year for
Kim.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I get a number of emails all the time from listeners in Spain and other European countries, and they are constantly envious of the entrepreneurial potential and money and market capability of the United States. And they claim that their economic structure doesn't support it, that they would have really hard times trying to do a space startup because there's no market in their country, and trying to get capital is very, very hard for a startup, and trying to get capital and bring technology or sell to the United States is extremely hard for them. One person in Spain that I know has been very successful with a tech company, has nothing to do with space, and he does come over and market in Silicon Valley and in other United States markets, and he's been trying to move here and to relocate his business here because he feels that in Spain it's very constrained. And another person has a very good technical business in Germany, and he has to come here to do all of his tech business with NASA and the space industry, even though Germany has a decent space agency and some kind of a space business, but they don't have the entrepreneurial kind of components, and they don't have the capital acquisition and market capabilities of the United States. So I hear about this mostly from people in Europe, and they feel very constrained by their economic and social structure and are very envious of the opportunity Americans have.
Mm.
This is all the time I get these emails.
Yeah.
So
I can believe that. I mean, I think the point about the size of the military supporting research of this kind is also very important. And just the sheer size of the market, you know,
yes,
all one language, it's always being unified. You know, that in itself is just such a huge factor.
Yes, that's true. And just to build on David's comments, what I find anecdotally is that U.S. companies will find that there's a niche player abroad, Europe, be it Canada or whatever, Asia, and a company that may be developing an expertise in a particular aspect of space flight or communications technology, and they will incorporate that or work some cooperative partnership. But David, you're absolutely right that companies are drawn to just the large nature and diversified nature of our market.
Anything else, Kim?
No, thanks for taking my call.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, Kim.
Have a good weekend. Courtney, I have a couple of emails for you. So Jeff is in New Orleans, and he says, I've known about your career and your work for a number of years, and I know that you have worked with or for various NASA administrators. Who did you actually work for, and how would you compare and contrast the NASA and the administrators you worked for with what's going on today and what may likely unfold for the future?
That's quite a question. Let's see if I can address it effectively. I worked directly for three administrators, Dan Golden, Sean O'Keefe, and briefly for Mike Griffin. All of this was in the 2000s, roughly 2000, 2001 to around 2005. Each had their own distinct personality, that's for sure. I would say that of the three, the one that I found the most interesting, and I think in some ways was the most effective, was Dan Golden. And I know that Dan was controversial in some quarters, but he brought a very interesting technical background. He was very open and encouraging of entrepreneurial activity, thought out of the box, very agile in his thought process, was constantly looking for ways to change the bureaucratic mindset. Although one could argue with the approaches that he might have taken and so forth, in my humble opinion, he ought to be applauded for at least making the effort. Each of them brought strengths and weaknesses, right? So that Sean O'Keefe brought his background as a former appropriator. He was quite close to the White House, the George W. Bush White House, so he brought a political acumen that was very effective in protecting the NASA budget, but was non-technical and arguably, was challenged by the fact that he did not have the depth of insight that I think an administrator needs to have from a technical standpoint. Mike Griffin certainly was very strong technically. He was a former chief engineer of the agency before assuming the top job. And was an architect behind the Constellation program, but did not have a lot of political chops and acumen, and so I think had some challenges in that regard. But again, was technically
very strong. Yeah.
It's an agency that is very tough, to find an administrator that has that right balance of experience, engineering acumen, and the political skill required to work your way through the politics of the White House West Wing and the not just stray cat, but the feral cats, if you will, that basically dominate the oversight infrastructure on Capitol Hill. And it's unusual to find that skill mix in one person. I don't know if I'm answering the full question, David.
Well, yeah, but she wanted to know how you see your experience related to NASA today and what may be in the future.
Well, I think that Charlie Bolden, the current administrator, has done as well as expected. I mean, he did not bring a lot of political experience to the table, and he has managed to, over time, to garner sufficient support from the administration so that they have for those of us who are space nerds, is there ever a sufficient budget, right? But at least the trajectory is in the right direction, about $19.8 billion, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So it's a nice increase over the last couple of years. But frankly, I think that whoever is Charlie's successor is going to inherit some pretty big challenges in terms of affirming the commercial focus and working with the SpaceXs and others out there, and continuing this trajectory vis-a-vis Moon, Mars, and a number of other challenges. And so finding that right man or woman with the appropriate mix of skill is a big challenge. And, you know, you search in vain when you look at the presumptive nominees for the Democrats and Republican on their websites for any reference to space. And, of course, that's not unusual, unfortunately, with presidential candidates. But given the prominence of space and what I think is the importance of it to our future, it's a bit disheartening not to see it a little bit more prominent.
On the one hand, Hillary remains close friends with Lori Garver, who has a proven space record. Whether
yes.
she would be an administrator or not, I don't know. And Trump seems to be very close with Newt Gingrich, who probably is the most informed person in Congress about space, despite his fiasco statements in the 2012 primary campaign in Florida. He's very knowledgeable and very supportive of commercial space.
Yes.
And he's supposedly on the short list, if there is such a short list. I just know what I read in the paper, and you take all that with a grain of salt.
Right.
As a VP candidate. And traditionally, presidents have delegated the VP to be in charge of space policy. So Gingrich would probably have a very strong commercial and space policy, because he really does know that stuff very well.
He does, and my only caveat, I would delete the word probably. He would absolutely be a gung-ho supporter
of space,
of commercial space, and his support goes back at least 30 years that I'm aware of. And
oh, it's bona fide. There's no question about that.
That would be good news. You're right. Normally, that portfolio is delegated to the vice president. When I was senior director for commercial space in the Bush 41 White House, it was Vice President Dan Quayle who was given that portfolio, and that is traditionally where it goes. And Newt certainly, as you say, has the bona fides that would bring great solace to those of us who think it ought to have a priority. But all bets are off right now as to where this will stand as a priority in the next administration. You know, David, I'm always curious when I'm listening to the debates and to the town halls, and knowing how many advocates we have in the space community, and I'm very proud of the fact that I was very much involved with the National Space Institute in the 70s, now known as the National Space Society. And we had then, and certainly today, many chapters around the country. The Planetary Society has been done extraordinary work in terms of their contributions to space exploration. I'm just always, among other groups that are out there, I'm always surprised that when the candidates are out and about in these town meetings and doing the retail politics, that there isn't someone that doesn't grab them and say, where do you stand on supporting space? At least I've not read or heard anything on radio, TV, where somebody has actually asked that question.
No, I've not seen it at a town hall meeting.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much that is really dramatically impacting voters in many ways, from their pocketbook to
yeah.
national security to health care to all of this. My suspicion is that the people who are turning out for these town halls are really keenly focused on these critical issues. Many of them are impacted by decisions that have been made, good or bad, and they have a personal stake in it. And I don't know how many people have a personal stake in space, for example, and are, you know, impacted as personally as, say, they are with health care or being scared to death about national security or
well,
something like that.
Let me make a call out to our fellow space nerds that having worked on campaigns, a few campaigns in my previous lives, I can tell you that all it takes is one or two questions at these different rallies and town meetings that leads a candidate, when he or she gets back into their SUV with their staff and they're focused on the next meeting, the candidate will say, where did that come from? And that suddenly, and it can lead to a staffer being assigned to find out more, and suddenly that becomes a talking point, and you'd be surprised where that goes. And we all know that space is so critical, right, to marketplace, absolutely, to the competitiveness of the country, and that I think you could we could make a pretty informed question regarding where that candidate stands.
I mean, it came up with Zimmerman the other night, Bob Zimmerman, and yeah, you know, it stands to reason that if you want to try to reduce our deficits and reduce government spending and all of that, that you would be pretty strongly supporting commercial space and private actors to grow the economy, to create jobs. I mean, that just sounds like a no-brainer.
That's exactly right. And you may recall that Donald Trump was asked in some form by a reporter or somebody asked him about space. NASA, does NASA deserve more money? And as I recall, his answer was that this country has many competing priorities, and for the moment, he said, it's not a top priority, but certainly I can see the importance of space, but we first have to tackle other issues. And that speaks to a lack of knowledge regarding the integral nature of space to our future, and a lack of knowledge regarding the fact that the Chinese and the Indians and others are not exactly hanging back, and so there's some real global leadership challenges that that a president is going to be confronting in the world of space, both in the civil, commercial, and national security realms. And you're exactly right. Commercial space, if you look at the trend lines, represents more and more a significant portion of our future economy, certainly from a telecom standpoint. Just the sheer impact of even the few commercial space imaging companies in terms of their impact on national security, for example, just to name one random example. So I'm hopeful that I'm hopeful every 48 years, and I end up being disappointed, but I remain hopeful that maybe in this cycle, which has an unbelievable noise signal ratio in terms of competing issues, I know that we'll manage to break through a little bit when it comes to the importance of space.
Well, my hunch is they see space more as an expense rather than an investment in the future. But
they needed to be educated about.
They should be up for some education. And you know, I don't know as much about Hillary's advisors on space other than Lori, probably. Mm-hmm. But certainly Gingrich, and he's very close to Sessions, although many in New Space don't like him. But he certainly understands the value and the need for NASA, for example. They ought to be able to get to him. So whether that's happening or they're all focused on other things, but God, every time the job market issue comes up in the economy, why the hell can't they talk about growing an industry that no other country can do except the United States?
That's right.
Why
and you
don't
can
they
do
that?
Without, I believe, without appearing to be flaky about it. You know, Newt
was flaky
and got criticized, as your listeners may recall, in the last presidential cycle when he was competing to be the Republican nominee. I think it was in Florida on the Space Coast, and he made reference to establishing a lunar base as a priority.
And a 51st state.
Yeah, and the media jumped all over him on that. And so there is a leeriness by the candidates, but again, that's because, as you are indicating, for whatever reason, no one has gotten to these candidates to say there's some real practical impacts that these companies are having now, today, again, ranging from national security to civil commercial.
Yeah.
And you could be on the leading edge, showing the American public that not only are you have the skill that you're claiming you have to deal with some today's global issues, but you also have a foot in the future and can grasp the importance of nurturing this emerging industry.
I know we're getting short on time, but you have another question. This is from Beth, who is in Seattle, Washington, by email. And Beth says, if you were brought in by a future White House, regardless of which party wins, how would you advise them on space, and what mix would you advise them on between, say, traditional space and NASA with commercial space?
Well, that's a very good question, and I guess I would first say look at space from a global standpoint. I think the mistake we make is compartmentalizing it as NASA versus the world, NASA versus other agencies. And I think that space has such a global footprint, and commercial space can be and is proving to be such an important source of helping defray taxpayer investment and helping to grow market that will benefit all sectors, let alone government agencies across the board, that I would first urge, if I was so honored, I would first say, let's stand back and look at this from an interdisciplinary, interagency standpoint. And I would certainly hope that that transition team would include some new blood, new perspective, representing the emergence of this new space. I think it's important. I tried when I was leading the transition for the George W. Administration to be as inclusive as I could, including the Congress. It always struck me as ridiculous that when you have these transition teams that it's so centric to the administration when, in fact, you can't get anything done, budget-wise, programmatic-wise, in terms of the big programs without having the involvement of the Congressional Oversight Committee. So better to bring them in from day one and be open to thinking about whether the NASA that was structured back in the 50s as a very large public organization makes sense in the age of flat, lean organizational models in the year 2016. Think about whether the growth of the headquarters bureaucracy and the way the field centers are structured vis-a-vis industry, vis-a-vis these new companies that are emerging, makes sense in 2016. I personally believe it doesn't, and I would hope that, again, I'm disappointed every 48 years that administrations don't focus on it, but I do think that, looking at ways to rethink, reinvent, the agency is long overdue. But it's very challenging because NASA tends to be an afterthought. It's a very interesting situation. The NASA administrator is one of the few independent agency heads that's a direct report to the President of the United States. And yet often what happens is that the agency is not, quote-unquote, discovered till about 6 months to sometimes a year into a new administration. Often the West Wing is populated by people who are illiterate regarding the space program. They know the pretty pictures that come from our space telescopes and from our space probes, and they are aware that occasionally we have some tragedies, all of the space shuttle accidents have taken place. And they're leery because in many cases they don't have a technical background and they don't really understand what takes place at 300 E Street, Southwest, NASA headquarters. So it tends to be put off, these issues. So if I could be granted Harry Potter's magic wand, I would push to have the agency be given, in space in general, a priority from day one, and frankly would recommend strongly that there be some good technical people that are versed in the world of space in the Science Advisor's office and other offices that advise the president, and that very serious attention be given to the type of skill mix that's required to ensure that the agency is effectively led. So that's my humble opinion how I'd go about it, David.
What have I omitted, or what should we have talked about that we haven't mentioned yet?
Oh boy, where do I begin? I think that there are some still fundamental issues that still need to be addressed to ensure that this, again, fragile new space industry, gets sufficient traction. So continuing to do the export control reform, property rights, private property rights. We can't hope to get our private entrepreneurs to, commit long-term capital, right, without assurances that they'll have sufficient ownership over their investments in mining or habitats or whatever form commercial takes place off this planet. So I think talking about that's important. Procurement reform is a recurrent theme, but we certainly have to address how the government goes about purchasing the services from industry. That would certainly be an important topic. Overall, just ensuring that the progress, and there has been, I think, significant progress made in terms of encouraging commercial space, that it's not reversed. And we will encounter failures. We've already had loss of life with one of the Virgin Galactic flights. To its credit, it dusted itself off. Lessons learned is moving on. To the credit of the FAA, they have understood that accidents will happen and did not respond with draconian reaction. There will be future failures, and unfortunately, we will probably witness additional loss of life along the line. This is dangerous stuff. The space environment is unforgiving. So another topic, David, would be to ensure that the government remains resilient, that the public at large recognizes that we need to remain supportive and agile even through the severe learning curve that will be associated with this exciting industry. And it's going to require internal vigilance on the behalf of all of us who believe in this industry so fervently. So that's a down payment on a few topics that we...
Well, we'll have to bring you back and talk about them. But
it'd be an honor.
That's a great way to break over the July 4th weekend, to be eternally vigilant, and that applies to many, many things in our society today. So keep that in mind, listeners. We will talk to you later in the year about some of these additional topics. It's great to finally have you a guest on the space show. And,
I can't believe 90 minutes has passed. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it goes by fast, doesn't it?
Very fast. And one item, too, to the our fellow space advocates, Juno spacecraft orbiting Jupiter on July 4th. Just a remarkable milestone, and I can't imagine a better way for those of us who've loved space to celebrate that day.
Absolutely, it'll be very, very exciting. Kind of
yes,
reminds
sir.
Me of Pathfinder on July 4th years and years ago.
Indeed.
Have a great weekend. I will let you know when I get the program archived and up on the website, and I look forward to this being the first of many space shows with you, Courtney. Glad to have you back.
Thank you so much. Thank you to your audience.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
And again, listeners, have a great, safe weekend. Remember, we are back live on Tuesday. Thanks to Courtney Stead and to all of you who participated. And goodbye from myself and the Space Show.